Let's rock and roll.
3, 4, 6.
Welcome, everyone. Call the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue to order. We have a public, our order of business today is going to be a public hearing on all of the bills that are listed, and then we will follow that by a work session on Senate Bill 250 for the purpose of incorporating amendments only. So at this point, I will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 824, Senate Bill 8, Senate Bill 336, Senate Bill 625, Senate Bill 714, Senate Bill 715, and Senate Bill 883. Chris.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Each of the bills deals with capital gains, and in your packet, you have a handout that includes a summary table of each of the bills, and at the top there are just a couple of bullet points about potential potential policies around capital gains taxation, just to provide a little bit of framework around the topic. And generally speaking, you can policy options include either broad policy changes or narrow policy changes. Examples of broad policy changes would be a general tax rate reduction or a specific capital gains tax rate, and you'll see some bills along those lines. And then you could also implement a full or partial exclusion or subtraction from capital gains. That would just be a subtraction for an amount of capital gains, maintaining existing tax rates. Narrow policy options would be some sort of deferral or exemption for investment in a certain type of entity. You'll see an example of that. Or specific circumstances, such as a rollover from one business to the next, or if somebody retires from owning a small business, those kinds of things. And the examples you have before you, Senate Bill 8 is an example of a subtraction for capital gains. Currently, the bill has a blank amount for a limit. Senate Bill 336 introduces a capital gains rate limited to 9% and puts any capital gains tax collections into the rainy day fund. Senate Bill 625 reduces the personal and corporate capital gains tax rates to 3%. It's phased down over 4 years. Senate Bill 714 limits the capital gains tax rate to 50% of the statutory rates. 715 is a 100% subtraction from personal and corporate taxes. And 824 provides a deferral of gain if invested in an Oregon business. And 883 is similar to 714 in that it provides a capital gains tax rate that is 50% of the statutory rate. And on that table, the applicability years are different. That's on there. And the other thing I just wanted to point out, just for general information, on the back of the handout, there is a history and the current forecast for Oregon collections from net capital gains taxation. Those are the bar charts on the top. The blue bars are the historical tax collections, and the red bar are the forecast. And then the two pie charts represent U.S. information. I don't have this readily available for Oregon, but it shows where the capital gains comes from for 1999 and 2007. Whether that be from the sale of corporate stock or real estate or capital gains distributions and mutual funds, those kinds of things. And a couple of things to point out there, in 1999, 43% of the net capital gains realized in the U.S. were from corporate stock, and 25% were from pass-through entities. This is information that gets reported to shareholders of S-corporations and partnerships. And the source of this information are a federal form called a K-1, so it doesn't specifically identify where that came from. So it's just it's categorized as this pass-through entity income. My understanding is the information is available, but the way the analysis was done, it's just identified from that source. And then looking forward to 2007, the big change there is the capital gains from these pass-through entities went from 25% in 1999 to 40%. In 2007. So that's just some very basic background information on capital gains.
And Chris, when somebody sells their business and it has that kind of liquidity event, which of these categories does it show up in?
It would probably be an other.
An other.
Okay. A corporate stock would be if somebody owns stock in Nike or Intel or Coca-Cola, something like that. Real estate would be the real property.
Okay. And Madam Chair?
Senator Telfer.
Thank you. Chris, would some of that also be a pass-through if a corporation or a partnership or an LLC sold something? That capital gain is going to get passed through if they sold
I believe it could be part of the pass-through. It's right now that's something of a mystery in terms of exactly what's in there.
Thank you. At this point, we have the rare honor of having our honorable Senate President lead off the testimony today, who will come up to the podium by himself. And having journeyed all the way from the second floor to lead off our testimony today, and we appreciate your presence here, Mr. President. Welcome.
You're fired.
I've been hoping for that. Welcome, Mr. President.
I want him up here with me. I don't like to be alone here.
Mr. President, I know that you'll over.
I'm Peter Courtney. I live at 2925 Island View Drive, Northeast Salem, 97303. That's how you're supposed to do it. And I'm a state senator, District 11. I was ordered here today by the chair of the committee, Senator Burdick. I was not ordered here today by the vice chair of the committee, Senator Shields. Senator Hass and Senator Telford didn't even know I was going to show up today, so I don't know what that means in terms of whether or not you really want me here or not. But
actually, Mr. President, our vice chair is Senator Morris.
Well, he doesn't look like one, so that's why I said that. I just said. He's been debate. I did introduce Senate Bill 8, and the thing about the presiding officer is you do get dibs on the first 10 bills if you want to use them. And so sometimes I think a number of a bill can be significant. So I am going to make a very general statement about capital gains. I'm very nervous about it because I don't know anything about capital gains. I'll never have any. So, but I did say things in the campaign. I've said things to editorial boards, and I've said things to Chamber of Commerce, and I'm very serious. And while I've handed out, I believe, is a written statement to you in deference to the respect I have for this incredible committee and each and every one of you, I'm very serious about this issue and what I hope we perhaps can do. I will not discuss the merits of capital gains. I am simply not an expert. I'm just going to flat out, this shall be shouldn't surprise any of you, I am not an expert on any tax issues, let alone capital gains, and I've already said I'll probably never have any. It should be obvious from the fact that I file a bill that I think it is a discussion or an issue that needs to be looked at very, very seriously, particularly by this august committee. It probably doesn't fit with what people think of when they think of Peter Courtney. Let's face it, and with all due respect, I am going to profile myself. I'm a Democrat, I'm a public employee, all those things that often are not associated with capital gains in terms of looking seriously at reducing or amending it in some way. Well, I do believe that overall taxes, and I'm not going to make a statement that I think can be verified, but some of you may take issues. I don't think that you can say that I think the overall tax on business are among the lowest in the country, but not when it comes to capital gains. I think it is indisputed evidence, I believe, Chairman, that our capital gains is the highest in the nation. I haven't been informed, after some thorough research, that we're right up there tied with Hawaii is the highest in the country. That is a very significant statement. That alone is one of the reasons we should look at this. It is a bipartisan committee. It is a bipartisan committee. It should consider whether or not we can reduce capital gains in a way that will directly help build our state's economy. Thank you again for letting me come here today, and I wish you luck. I know you will be thorough and fair, and I know, like me, that each of you wants what's best for Oregon. So how you do it, when you do it, and what way you do it, I don't know. But I really do think it's something that we need to look at and be serious about it. I know you will be, and that is why I introduced Senate Bill 8, and that is why I was most willing to come here and make a very general statement about it, Chair Burdick and members of the Senate Revenue and Finance Committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Are there questions? Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Okay, now we will have a panel of Senator Atkinson and Senator Olson. And is Representative Reed here? He's what? He's on his way. We will ask Representative Reed to join the panel when he gets here. And Senator Atkinson, this is another unfairness to you in view of your seniority and esteem, but Senator, I would like to let Senator Olson go first since he has some place he needs to be.
By all means.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Morris, and committee members. For the record, my name is Alan Olson, and as prescribed by our Senate President, I live at 2475 North Baker Drive, Canby, Oregon. I represent Senate District 20, encompassing Canby, Oregon City, Gladstone, Oak Grove, Johnson City, and Barlow. I'm here to speak today on Senate Bill 883. And in reference to our distinguished Senate President who gets Senate Bill 8, I am at Senate Bill 883, so you can see where I am on the food chain. This bill requires capital gains at all levels to be cut in half. I know that you have many similar bills before you. The necessity for capital gains cuts is tantamount to do the following. Provide more capital for Oregon employers to expand capacity, expand workforce, and thereby expand revenue for the state general fund. Improve the image of Oregon in the world market to say to all, we value your business and we would like you to choose Oregon as your place of business. We are tied with Hawaii for the highest capital gains in the United States. This gives a negative perception for companies looking to relocate or start a new business. Governor Kitzhaber, in his own budget, realizes the importance of a capital gains correction. Madam Chair and members, there are many good bills that deal with capital gains. I urge you in your deliberations to consider all bills and to send to the floor a bill that will say to all, Oregon is open for business. Please come join us. Thank you for your consideration.
And thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? We will let you go now.
Thank you
very
much.
Thank you for coming. Senator Atkinson.
Madam Chair, thank you. As the senior member of the Tall Guy Caucus, I would be happy to be a bookend to President Courtney and allow the good representative whose name was most unfortunately misspelled on the state mug speak first.
Welcome, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, I'm Tobias Reed, unlike what it says on the mug, State Representative from District 27. If only Senator Atkinson were right, it was not just my name that was misspelled on the mug, it was my names, both first name and last name. The most unfortunate part of that story is that when I went to the gift shop and asked for one, they'd gotten rid of them all. I thought they would at least share one or save one for me to keep as a souvenir, but alas, they'd gotten rid of them all. I'm happy to be before you just to add to the conversation about capital gains and tell you about a version or an approach that that is before you. I caught the tail end of Senator Olson's testimony, and a lot of what motivated my interest in this is the idea that being at or near the top of the list on capital gains keeps us from getting farther in the conversation with people who are making decisions about where they might live or operate their businesses, so that we're not as able to tell the story about all the other great things in Oregon. And so that's a big part of the motivation for this concept. The other is the recognition that capital gains are among the most volatile sources of our revenue. If you're like me, you remember some of the statistics associated with our revenue volatility. In the House Revenue Committee, we get a lot of statistics, and I know you do here as well. The you might remember the standard deviation on the personal income tax forecast is 5.6%. The corporate is 34%, and I'm assured that the number is even higher with capital gains. So the second thing our version does is to put the dollars associated with capital gains in the rainy day fund. I recognize that there are a lot of different approaches and a lot of things you might consider when it comes to capital gains, but I wanted to make sure that that's part of the discussion. And I had no idea that the last time I was making these comments before the House Revenue Committee that it might become part of the PolitiFact, but it was. And so it's been verified, thanks to Chris and others, that we are, in fact, at or near the top of the list on capital gains. I think that underscores the importance of that that conversation. So I appreciate the time. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for coming. Questions? Now, Senator Atkinson, you are on.
Thank you. It's an honor to follow Tobolus Reed. Is that what
Tobolus.
It was?
Tobolus.
Yes. T-O-B-L-A-S.
For the record, Jason Atkinson, Southern Oregon. I just handed the representative the Truth-O-Meter article and some fact that President Courtney alluded to about the highest in the country and the competition for that record with Hawaii. If you could turn your attention to two bills, one Senate Bill 714 and the other 15. Those are my contributions. And while this has been a almost a legacy type of an issue for many, as you very Solomon-esquely lay out what should be the policy, if in fact we are in agreement that having this recognition as the most expensive is not the correct public policy, I would urge you to look at the two approaches that I've taken. And the reason is based on my experience. Now, my experience certainly doesn't speak for everyone, but in my experience, I will give you a handful of examples here from my business life. One of my larger clients, now many years ago, moved to Vancouver based on two things. One was taxation rates, and the second, general business taxation rates, and secondly was capital gains. And I was in those discussions where we're doing, as from the business perspective, the cost benefit of taxation in Oregon versus business expansion. It was a very difficult thing. It was a company that was begun out of a van in Beaverton and had grown to three states and a leader in their industry, and they moved with them 50 families to their new headquarters just across the river. Second was a business partner of mine who was from Texas, came to Oregon, and moved back to Texas, a place with no capital gains. Now, did they have other taxes? Yes, but as a business investor, they found a place that was more favorable for long-term financial planning. Anyway, I could give ancillary examples from my own career of this tax rate or this problem. But I build upon these two bills for your consideration based on those experiences, and I have made a clear distinction in these approaches of doing an automatic get to what the policy should be. The legislature oftentimes says, well, we're going to have a step down or a phased in approach or any other type of legislative talk for not doing it immediately. Now, if you put yourself in the position of the investor or a business or a person selling real estate, I will tell you that if we're trying to generate capital into our economy and we have a phase-down approach, no smart investor, seller, business person is going to make that change until they're at the absolute lowest rate. And so if we are going to go from, let's say hypothetically, 11% to 9% to 7% down to 5%, hypothetically, the smart money would be waiting until you're down to 5%. What my bills do is they say if we're going to make a change, get to that immediately or even get to that temporarily quickly to generate revenue into our economy. So the discussions I've had, which lead to both of these bills, have essentially been, if you read both of them, you'll see that I think it's better policy I think that having the highest capital gains tax is just terrible. I think it is an absolutely robbery of market opportunities in capital. But if you share that position, I would encourage the committee not to do a step down type of approach. I would say go automatically down quickly and let the word go out. So the second policy discussion is, well, should we make this temporary or should we make this permanent? I think it should be permanent. It might be political feasible to do it temporary. But regardless, I would say get to the lowest rate as quick as you can so that the investment can get freed up as quick as it can. If you do a phase down, I think, given the fact that we still think around here in terms of biannual sessions, even though we are now annual sessions, we still have that mindset of how we do budgets and forecasting and other bills I've testified before you on. We still have a two-year mindset. I think if we do a phased-down approach, this reform will fail miserably in the free market. Those are my comments about those two bills, and Madam Chair, I hopefully have shaken and generated some questions.
Thank you. Are there questions of Senator Atkinson or Representative Toblas? Reed. I presume Reed was spelled R-E-E-D.
Correct, it was.
All right. Thank you both for coming and for your testimony. Okay. We're going to, our next panel will be Jeremy Rogers and Larry Scruggs. And Bob Wiggins, why don't you come up on this panel as well? Welcome.
Senator Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeremy Rogers, 2015 Northwest Flanders Street, number 101, Portland, Oregon. And I am the project director for the Oregon Business Council and the project manager for the Oregon Business Plan, which is a collaborative effort between public and private leaders to strengthen Oregon's economy. I appreciate the work of this committee and the opportunity to testify before you. I believe that the work you're doing here is fundamental, both for creating jobs in the state and for providing adequate revenue, stable revenue for critical public services. One of the primary goals of the business plan is to raise Oregon's per capita income above the U.S. average. It's currently about 90% of the U.S. average. It's been declining for more than a decade, and particularly declining compared to our neighbors to the north in Washington, which are about 105% of the U.S. average, and that's been growing compared to the rest of the nation for a decade. This decline in wealth in our community is not only significant because of its impact on individuals and families and their wallets and ability to provide for themselves, but also for the state budget. Less personal income means less tax revenue, which leads to fewer services, and fewer services, particularly in education, leads to further declines in income. It's a toxic cycle, and we believe that Oregon's unique in the nation, tax policy is one of the factors contributing to it. Oregon has the highest income and capital gains taxes in the nation, or tied with Hawaii, and is only one of several states that does not offer a reduced tax rate for capital gains. The rate at 11%, and will settle down to 9.8 in a couple years, but Washington State, which is only a few miles from downtown Portland, has no capital gains tax. And that's particularly important because one can enjoy all of the same quality of life amenities in Washington State as it can in Oregon, really creating kind of a unique in the nation circumstance of the contrast between the tax rates. Concerned about the impact that this was having on wealth in the community, we hired Echo Northwest in 2009 to take a look at this and determine if there was significant wealth migration heading towards Clark County from the Portland area, Oregon, Portland metro counties. And you have a copy of the study in front of you, and particularly one table, which is stapled to my testimony, I'll be referring to. What the study did was compare the incomes of those in Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties that moved to Clark County versus those that reside in Clark County and then move to Multnomah, Clackamas, or Washington. And what you can see in the table is that on average, those moving from the Oregon counties to the Washington county earned 37% more than those moving in the opposite direction. And that income gap tracked the performance of the S&P 500 almost to a T. The next two graphs that are in the packet will show you two lines. One is the S&P 500, and the other is the net outflow of adjusted gross income from those three Oregon counties to Clark County. And you can see those lines match up almost exactly. And just to highlight that, in a year where the stock market was doing very well in 1999, those moving from the Oregon counties to the Washington counties actually made 68% more than those moving in the other direction. And then that year alone, that accounted for $127 million in lost income because of the differential. And that only, of course, is just in the first year of that move. And in all, over like about 15 years of looking at this, there's about $1.3 billion outflow of income just in the first year that people make that move. It doesn't count taxable income of those individuals in subsequent years of their life. It does not count individuals who moved to Washington from counties other than Multnomah, Clackamas, or Washington. It doesn't count individuals who never moved to Oregon in the first place. There's several problems with this. One, of course, is that when someone leaves, we're losing, in many cases, all of their taxable income. Certainly, any capital gains, but also if they stay in Washington and or if they move their business to Washington or if they don't come here at all, in the first place, we're losing all of that wealth that could be invested in the community that could be taxed at our tax rate, income tax rates, and be applied to fund public services. But more importantly, those are folks that build companies, that own companies, that have employed people, that become angel investors, that finance new companies, that mentor new entrepreneurs. And they're also philanthropists, so it's a huge deal to have a policy that is a disincentive for these types of people to be located here. And Oregon is an amazing place. That's why we're all here working so hard to preserve its qualities and make it better. But it's not an island. Hawaii is one. We approach tax policy like we are an island. Progressivity is a huge value in a tax system, but it's not the only value. The incentives that your tax system creates for wealth creation, for investment, for business startups, that is also a very important value that I think we need to consider, and not just pat ourselves on the back for the progressivity of our system, which we should be proud of, but also balance that with the right incentives for economic activity and economic growth. I also wanted to put this in a broader context of some other things that this committee and the body is looking at this year related to tax and budget policy. Oregon has a kicker law that unexpectedly sends billions of dollars back to taxpayers. No one plans on this money or makes decisions based on it. It shows up in no national studies comparing state-by-state tax burdens. It doesn't show up in Forbes magazine or publications that target business owners and investors. At the same time, we continue to have income and capital gains taxes at the highest rates in the nation. In an interregional context where an individual can choose to gain the same quality of life amenities in Oregon with 11% or 9.8% and 0% in Washington. This tax, the capital gain, shows up in every state-by-state tax comparison. It is talked about in those publications that are targeted at business owners and investors. So this body is considering legislation to modify the kicker and require disciplined savings from the general fund budget to fill a reserve fund. It's also considering reducing capital gains taxes. Taken together, I think these changes would dramatically improve Oregon's tax system. The system would be more stable. It would provide stronger incentives for economic growth, and the increase in the kicker revenues could offset losses from capital gains revenue. This body could, with no or minimal hit to the general fund, dramatically improve Oregon's tax system this legislative session by working on a suite of these measures. So doing so, I think, would send a signal to the rest of the world that Oregon is disciplined, strategic, and that it's open for business. Thanks for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I think we'll complete the panel and then open it for questions. Sure. Who would like to go next?
I guess.
Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Morse, my name is Larry Scruggs. I reside at 6942 North Villard Avenue in Portland. To establish my credentials to testify here, I hold a PhD in policy analysis from Portland State and have held senior administrative positions in higher education and business throughout my career, which is now over. I'm retired. I come to you today to argue against cutting capital gains taxes and present the following information to substantiate my position. Weller of the Economic Policy Institute argues that corporate tax cuts and reductions in capital gains taxes will likely improve the bottom line for companies and boost the wealth of stockholders, but they will do little to stimulate the economy, and I would add, or create jobs. Businesses are unlikely to spend the money they will receive from lower taxes, rather they are likely to save it. Stockholders are just as unlikely to spend all of their additional income from capital gains tax cuts, thereby reducing the effectiveness of this tax cut and enhancing demand. Both tax cuts are likely to increase corporate and private savings, which means less spending, which is exactly the opposite of what this economy needs right now. Fisher and Ditzler of the Iowa Policy Project, in their research on capital gains tax cuts in Iowa, found that they are totally irrelevant to Iowa's economic growth. They found that there are several reasons for the limited effects of capital gains taxes on growth. One, about half of the capital gains are not taxed anyway. And two, a cut in capital gains taxes reduces only the cost of investment financed by equity, which is approximately one-third of corporate and business investment. The rest, or about one-third, excuse me, is financed through debt. I'd like to know how capital gains tax cuts are going to stimulate the economy in Oregon. Where's the data showing that capital gains tax cut will increase more jobs in Oregon and improve our economy? Friedman and others from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities show that business tax cuts do not necessarily create jobs. Their research shows the following. One, the theory that less taxes equals more jobs does not hold true. More demand for products creates more jobs. Two, American corporations are more profitable now than they were at the beginning of the recession, but they're still not hiring. And three, reducing the tax overhead for a business or an individual allows them to reallocate tax expenditures elsewhere, but not necessarily to hire more workers. We've had significant federal tax cuts in 2001, 2003, and 2010, and I ask you, where are the jobs? Those who say our capital gains tax rate hurts business need to look at our overall tax rates in Oregon. Don't just use one tax rate to prove a point. Rather, use Oregon's overall tax rate to show that we are favorable to business. According to the Tax Foundation, we're 14th in state business tax climate. The Public Policy Institute of New York ranks its 9th in the same thing. Our recommendations relating to capital gains taxes are as follows. One, continue to follow federal law and allow up to 60% exclusion of capital gains for investing in small business corporations as defined in 26 U.S.C. 1202. Continue to tax all income the same. And please, before you pass something like this, conduct a cost-benefit analysis of these bills. How much will this cost the state of Oregon in lost revenue? And how much will we gain from this reduction in taxes? How many jobs will be created? And how much development will result directly from these cuts? We're in a very difficult financial position in Oregon right now, and frankly, we don't see how more tax cuts are going to help us solve our problems. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. And before we go to our next witness, I endeavor to get the panels all in the same position, but nobody today except Lori Wimmer filled out their position, so I'm having to do guesswork. So my apologies for mixing and matching here.
Apologize.
Makes it interesting.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and Vice Chair Moore, Senators. My name is Bob Wiggins, resident of Multnomah County. I'm the manager of Mount Hood Equity Partners, LP, which is a venture capital fund headquartered in Lake Oswego. Our investors are all wealthy individuals. None of our funding is from the Oregon Growth Account or the Oregon Investment Fund. Mount Hood Equity Partners invests in early-stage technology companies located in the Pacific Northwest. In most cases, these companies have also raised equity investment from angel investors. Over the past 15 years, I've also made angel investments as an individual in a number of Oregon-based startups. I'm here today to encourage the legislature to modify the Oregon income tax by reducing the tax rate applicable to long-term capital gains. The legislature is considering a number of different bills on this subject, which take several different approaches to the issue. I intend today to briefly discuss the various approaches, but first, I'd like to address why this issue really is important to Oregon. One important effect of a change to Oregon's approach to capital gain taxation will be to stem the tide of wealthy Oregonians leaving the state when they're about to sell their business. This matters for many reasons, not the least of which is that when an Oregonian moves from the state, Oregon collects its 11% capital gain tax on $0 since these people are no longer Oregon residents. I want to focus on a different issue, though, the impact of Oregon's highest in the country capital gains rate on angel investment in Oregon. Angel investment is a critical part of the growth path of many companies that ultimately become significant employers. Angel investors are wealthy individuals, many of whom became wealthy by building and then selling their own businesses. These investors then reinvest some of the proceeds of the sale of their business in new businesses. Sometimes the angel runs the new business. Sometimes they serve as a director or advisor. Sometimes they're just passive investors. Companies that I've invested in over the past 15 years, either as an individual angel or through Mount Hood Equity Partners, include Routeware, a very fast-growing Beaverton company in the waste management technology space that currently employs 20 people. Site9, a rapidly growing Portland software company with customers all over the world that currently employs 10 people. Learning.com, a Portland company that was a pioneer in online delivery of educational software, which currently employs 100 people. Varis Industries, a Tigard company in the automation system peripherals business, which currently employs over 100 people. BLT Technologies, a telecommunications company that was headquartered in Vancouver and at its height employed 160 people. Legal Anywhere, a Tualatin-based legal software company that employed 25 people, and many others. There are hundreds of angel-funded businesses in Oregon which employ thousands of people. They were started with equity financing provided by local angel investors and have not depended on any investment from the taxpayers. Not all companies start with angel investment. Many small businesses were started with the labor and funds of the founders and their families. What sets angel-funded companies apart is that they need larger amounts of early equity, in part because their growth plans are more ambitious. And not every high-growth company starts with angel money either. Some businesses receive early funding from large industry players or government grants or venture capital firms. But for many high-growth businesses, without angel funding, they would not have gotten off the ground. And remember, in many cases, the angel doesn't just provide money. Often they also provide advice and support that is critical to new entrepreneurs. To build fast-growing businesses that employ lots of Oregonians, angel investment is an essential part of the mix. Oregon should want as many angels as we can to live here. Unfortunately, our tax policy and the proximity of income tax-free Washington and the 48 other states that tax capital gains at a lower rate than Oregon serve as a strong incentive to individuals who are about to have a large capital gain on a sale of their business to establish residency in another state, avoiding Oregon's highest in the country capital gain tax. Does this really happen? Of course it does. I know business people who have moved out of the state to avoid taxes. I'll leave it to Jeremy and others to testify as to the empirical evidence, but I will note that of the investors in Mount Hood Equity Partners who were Oregon residents 10 years ago, over 20% no longer are, and the pace of that change accelerated last year. It is true that some Oregonians who leave remain engaged in Oregon's business and charitable world, but many do not, and none of them who ever leave pay any further Oregon income taxes. I know many people do not think it is fair that capital gains are taxed federally at a lower rate than ordinary income, and therefore are very happy with the current Oregon situation. Here's why a lower capital gain rate is in fact fair. If you go to work as an employee, you have a legal right to your wages. Your employer has to pay you what you earned. You don't have to make an investment in the employer to get your job. Of course, you can lose your job, as thousands of Oregonians have, but whatever wages you have earned are yours. Wages are taxed at ordinary income rates federally. If you make an equity investment, whether in a business or real estate or some other asset, you may someday sell the investment at a profit. You could also completely lose the entire amount of your investment. The entire amount invested is at risk. Risk capital is essential to economic growth, and the federal tax code has at least tried to encourage risk capital. That is at least part of the reason why the U.S. Congress has always taxed capital gains at a lower rate than ordinary income. I'd like to take just a couple minutes to discuss the various approaches to this issue that the legislature is considering. Ideally, we would just adopt a lower tax rate for all transactions that give rise to a long-term capital gain under federal law. I don't think it's necessary or fair for Oregon to eliminate capital gain taxation completely. I'm convinced, however, that if Oregon reduced its capital gain rate to a level closer to other states, that we would lose fewer potential angel investors to Washington or other states. One approach included in some of the bills is a capital gain rollover feature. While a rollover-based bill would probably be better than nothing, I do not think it will accomplish what its proponents hope that it will. Here's the problem. When a business owner is working on the sale of his or her business, the owner has to decide before the sale closes whether to change his or her residence to Washington, completely eliminating the risk of Oregon capital gain taxation on the entire gain, assuming that the owner actually moves and follows the rules. A rollover-based rule will leave uncertainty. Maybe the seller will find an investment that meets the requirements of the rollover rule within the required time, and maybe the amount available to invest will cover his or her gain, but that is a lot of uncertainty. No one will make what they believe is a stupid underlying investment just to meet the requirements of a rollover rule. I suspect that faced with having to make a decision before the sale and uncertainty as to whether they can satisfy the rollover rule requirements compared with the certainty of result if they move, most sellers will continue to choose to move. Oregon tried a rollover-based approach before in the 1990s with disappointing results, and the federal tax code has included a rollover provision from time to time on sales of small businesses, and I believe the utilization of that has been low as well. My own experience is that benefits under these rules have been a matter of post-transaction luck and have not affected my pre-transaction behavior. If the legislature cannot reach agreement on an across-the-board rate cut of capital gains, I still think there is an alternative approach that would be more effective than the rollover approach. Instead of focusing on the reinvestment of proceeds of a sale, I think it makes more sense to focus on the sale itself. Oregon could, for example, provide a reduced capital gain rate for Oregon taxpayers for the sale of businesses that meet a very strict definition. This could include a long holding period, say 5 years, illiquidity of the investment. For example, shares of a publicly traded company would not satisfy the rules requiring that the underlying business assets actually be in Oregon, and perhaps other requirements as well. The idea would be that Oregon capital gain treatment would truly be available only for sales of Oregon businesses that have been held for a long time and not capital gains in general. Then when a business sale is imminent, the seller would know for sure whether or not he qualified for Oregon capital gain treatment, and assuming he did, he wouldn't even be tempted to move in the first place. Our goal should be to keep high net worth residents in our state. If they stay, it is more likely they will reinvest in Oregon businesses, and in any event, they will continue to be Oregon taxpayers and participate in Oregon public and charitable life. If we want a thriving, growing economy, and I know we all do, the state needs business people who are willing to put some of their profits from the sale of their businesses back to work in Oregon. And we need as many of those people in Oregon as we can. I'd be happy to respond to questions.
Thank you very much. I wanted to ask the two of you what if you have an opinion on if there is a lower rate for some or all of capital gains transactions, how you feel about a phased-in approach.
Well, I think that you need to make the rule what the rule is so that people know the rule and that you can tell the world this is the rule. A phased-in approach, I think, it won't accomplish what you're trying to accomplish, as well as just saying we're going to bite the bullet and do it.
Okay, thank you.
That's my opinion, and that's only an opinion.
Did you want to comment?
Yeah, I actually don't feel like I'd be great at answering that question.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Senator Hess.
Thank you. If you buy into the notion, and statistically it shows that Oregon's business taxes overall are mid-pack or even below that. And we do have the highest capital gains rate in the country, and we want to balance these out by lowering the capital gains down below 9 or to 5. Where would you say would be the best place to then equalize that with some other kind of elimination of a tax break, or where would you go to pay for that?
Senator Haas, I mean, what I referred to in my testimony was, I think the combined tax change of the kicker reform and capital gains would be a combination that net could really, over the long term, have no impact on the general fund, but have a significant impact on the economy and the stability of the budget.
I would like to respond to that, too. First, recognize long-term capital gains on sales of businesses are not business taxes. They're taxes on individuals. Businesses and corporations can have capital gains, certainly, but these are individual taxes. So when you point to the various things that are saying we have a business tax climate that is middle of the road, that really doesn't address this issue. Secondly, you know, what makes up business taxes affects different taxpayers differently. And the fact that we don't have a B&O tax or a sales tax certainly is a benefit to companies that have either lower gross revenue or don't use a lot of tangible personal property in their business. But it doesn't necessarily help a business that doesn't have those things, like a software business or something else. So in a sense, we have sort of the worst business taxation structure for certain kinds of businesses. Nobody elected me to anything, so I don't have an answer other than I agree on the kicker, And I think that you do have some issues that are worth looking at in terms of the particular tax credits. And again, I'm just speaking for myself, but I think there's some room for some work there too.
I agree. I mean, obviously, the businesses, individuals, and everybody pay capital gains. I'm looking at it from an economic development play, and somehow we have to lose this headline that we have of the highest capital gains.
Yeah.
It is a huge detriment.
It's poison.
And I'm just, you know, to deal with that and a $3 billion deficit and schools cutting teachers and cutting days, where is the equalization there? Where would be the smart play here if we want to lower this one and make sure that we still have schools running all year long?
I mean, again, the kicker doesn't solve your problem in 2011, 2012, but as far as I'm concerned, bail on the kicker. You will, I think, have not as bad of an economic or as bad of a tax consequence reducing the capital gain rate as you think you will, because I do strongly believe it will positively reduce the outflow of high net worth individuals. Now, it won't, you know, I'm not suggesting, oh, it's going to completely magically make up for it, but you know, that's why you guys make the big bucks, is figuring out how you're going to do that.
You noticed all the laughter from the audience when you said that. Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In addressing the proposal that the capital gains rate trend downward on a glide path downward, to use Senator Morris's terminology, versus a immediate reduction to spark the economic development that occurred. Now, so my question is going to be, as a CPA, I know how to structure a transaction, and so if it's a gradual reduction in the rate, you structure the transaction as an installment sale with a lot of interest up front and principal payment when you're down to the 5%. Do you see that impacting and answering the chair's question regarding an immediate reduction versus a slow reduction? Do you see that being any different or having any impact in making a difference? Because again, we can structure the transaction, but it does mean not a lot of cash up front.
And this will just be my reaction. While certainly you can use installment reporting to evade the rule, my always rule is cash is good and I want it quick. So I wouldn't be structuring around the timing of the Oregon capital gain thing. I want my money as soon as I can get my money, and sooner if possible.
It's a wise comment.
Cash is like a true venture capitalist.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We had a report from our treasurer, I think it was last summer, quarterly forecast, and part of that was dealing with at least a brief reference to in-migration, out-migration based on family income. And what particularly caught my eye in that report was the outgrowth of high-income families from our state. There was a net in-migration of low-income, very significant positive in-migration of middle income, but a significant outflow migration of family income greater than $200,000. And I'm wondering, Jeremy, did in the study that was done, you looked at the, tried to capture the in-migration, out-migration in the three-county area. Did you look at the state at all as a whole and then look at it on the demographics based on family income?
We didn't do that. Yeah, there is another study, and this doesn't answer your question, but I'll just throw it out there so you know it exists. There's another study that was done nationally, looking at all the areas where you have a metropolitan area with two state lines and the income tax differential, and there was very significant effects. And what they looked at was not the migration once someone lives there, but once someone decides to move into that area, which state do they choose to live in? And that study showed significant issues. And the situation between Oregon and Washington is the most severe differential that exists in the U.S. And we've asked the authors of that study, which from some universities in the Southeast, to try to do a run just on the Portland area to see the effect. It doesn't answer your question, but I just wanted to let you know that also exists out there. Yeah.
Well, I think, Madam Chair, to follow up, you mentioned early on in your testimony Oregon's per capita personal income, and that's very troublesome. And it just begs the question for policymakers to ask the question, why? Why are we declining? Is it our tax code? Is it the water we drink? I mean, it can't be that dissimilar to our state to the north, because we enjoy similar amenities. We have blue sky, mountains, streams, oceans, lakes, all of the things that attract people for living. But what is there about Oregon that makes us a laggard in terms of earnings? And I would suggest to you that it's more than just capital gains. It's the nature of our entire tax system that is a drag on capital formation, retention, and investment. I would share with you what was shared with me. As you know, Corvallis is home to a major HP installation. They have vacant space in that building, fab space, very high valuable space. The company was looking to locate. And it was ready to go. And they chose to go to Texas, previous testimony, zero capital gains. And the reason that they did not stay or did not choose Oregon was our tax code. We never know about those opportunities because they've never come. You just hear about those kinds of things. I can tell you in response to Mr. Wiggins.
I'm Wiggins.
Wiggins. Scruggs.
He's the...
You know, I can tell you that in my business experience, I've had business partners that have left this state because of the tax code.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly. And I have friends, the list would go from here to the door, that have left this state because of the tax code. And so the question, I think, for us is how do we reverse that 90% and dropping of the national average of personal per capita income? That's really the driver. We survive on income taxes. And if you're in that declining base, how do we reverse that? And I would suggest that the issue really is in terms of balancing a dollar for dollar, it's hard to do because it'll take a while to pull out of this and put this state on its path, going upward, not downward.
Senator Morris, just a response to that. Think of all the jobs and businesses that were created just in deals that I was a personal investor in. Not a nickel of state money was put into that to create all those jobs. They're real jobs for real companies that sell something that the market really wants to buy. But we're shooting ourselves in the foot by making it hard with a 11%, and I guess it'll be 9.8%. Next year or the year after. We're making it hard to get people that are willing to do that early stage funding to do it. And it could be a lot easier.
Well, as a follow-up, Madam Chair, if I may.
I'm sorry.
I appreciate your comments, but, when people make that investment as a venture capitalist, what do you expect?
What do I expect?
Yes. Let me lead you.
Well,
you expect a liquidity event at some point in time. This is not an investment that you're going to hold as you would a family business that this is my career, it's my life, and at some point in time I'll sell it. As an investor, if you're providing that seed capital to create something new, there is an expectation of liquidity at some point in time.
Absolutely. Five, okay. Six, 7 years. But I would argue even in a family business, at some point, there's a few that make the intergenerational transfer, but ultimately those are sold too.
Yes. Yes.
Mr. Scruggs, did you want to come in on that?
Yes, one, if I may. Regarding the declining income in the state of Oregon, that declining income average, I think we need to incorporate the current recession and go back to 2008 and look at our unemployment rate, which has been disturbingly high now for three and a half years. That certainly has contributed to that decline in income, and I don't have any data, and I would ask if you gentlemen have any data to substantiate how much of that decline in income is because of the wealthy people leaving the state, and how much of that is because of people that are chronically unemployed and cannot get jobs. I know, by the way, from my own personal experience, I know people who have sold a business here in Oregon, but the year that they sold the business, they moved to Washington for a year. And they moved to Washington to avoid paying the capital gains tax, but then they moved right back the following year after they had taken care of that. And I'm wondering if any of you know people of similar experience.
Well, this is, all anecdotal. There's anecdotes mm-hmm. all over the map. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
J.O. Wilson, Roger Beyer, and Jan McCumes. Welcome.
Thank you. Chairwoman Burdick and members of the committee, for the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing Associated Oregon Industries. Like everybody else, we're looking at ways to break out of our stagnancy, where we have unemployment higher than national average and wages that are below national average, and just simply a lack of wealth in the state and what we can do to turn the situation around. One of the situations, to echo the sentiments of Senator Morse, in the absence of full tax reform, which AOI has historically been in favor of, the one change we would make for the tax code that we feel would be beneficial to job creation and income growth would be a reduction in the capital gains tax rate, either a reduction in the rate or an increase in the exclusion to arrive at that effective outcome. The reality is we have the highest rate on exactly what we want to incent capital formation, investment, and growth, which is something that adversely impacts the rate of return on investment. And the reality is we have to compete for capital formation and investment with all the other states that surround us. And one of the situations that I'm familiar with and how jobs are created just within my own membership, we've got members who work their way up to senior management of some of the bigger companies, see market opportunities. They liquidate their stock and their companies, and they go off on their own to fill their own market niches and create their own products and spin off their own companies, and that is something we see all the time. And they liquidate their stock to accumulate assets and put them into use. Their capital is used to create a product and hire employees, which is another taxable event. The demand for workers increases wages because you increase the demand there, which increases a wage base and taxable wage base. And then some people choose to do it all over again, or they reward themselves with a lifetime of work and risk, and they reap those rewards through selling their companies. I guess the question is why would you preclude yourself from all of those taxable events that would occur if you had, in fact, a tax system in place that incented that type of investment and capital formation? And I guess the follow-up question is, do you think you can really create that level of investment in this state when you're taxing capital gains at about 10%? Especially when you look at all the surrounding states, Wyoming, Nevada, Washington, all at 0%. Colorado, Utah, Arizona, Montana, New Mexico, all at 5% or less. And so we're really operating in isolation. Only California taxes capital gains as high as we do. And we're in a marketplace in the West with states that have capital gains rates largely at 5% or less. And if we want to be in the ballgame, it would seem to be that we would do something equivalent. So, again, we would support a capital gains rate reduction in the absence of wholesale tax reform. We think it is the one thing we can do to start to grow job opportunities, start to reverse the decline in incomes in this state that we want to see.
You're welcome.
Chair Burdick and committee, My name is Jan Meekums. I'm the state director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. Our members are made up of 7,000 small businesses in the state of Oregon. And we have about 350,000 members nationwide, all small businesses. I wish to address one particular element of capital gains tax issue as it affects our small business members. Much of what has been mentioned today certainly does affect them. But according to the Small Business Administration, Oregon has over 300,000 small businesses. About 1 in 10 adult Americans ages 18 to 64 years are currently taking active steps to create a business. And where will they do that? Where will they set up shop and create a business that hires people? Virtually all are doing so because they want to, not because they have to. They are America's entrepreneurs. They're Oregon's entrepreneurs. They are the economic engine of this country and of our state. They are the innovators. They are the risk takers, and most importantly, they are the job providers, providing over 57% of Oregon's private sector employment. For our small business members, the issue of capital gains is a big issue. For most do not invest in the stock market. They do not have pension plans, 401ks, or even IRAs. A sad statement. What they do have is their businesses. That is their primary investment portfolio. They invest back into their business to maintain it, to grow it, and provide jobs. What is the carrot that drives them to take significant personal and economic risks, work hard, and reinvest in their enterprise? It is the hope and the dream that they can provide for themselves, their family, and their employees along the way to a secure future retirement. That when the time comes, 25 or 30 years down the road, that they will have a valuable asset to sell that will provide for a comfortable, financially stable endgame. After paying taxes at all levels throughout one's business life, then to be faced with high capital gains tax because of doing business and providing jobs in Oregon is punitive. As you are well aware, Oregon has one of the highest personal and corporate tax rates in the country and also has the highest capital gains rate, a triple tax whammy, and that doesn't even bring up the subject of estate tax. We believe Oregon's capital gains tax needs a significant reduction. A reduced capital gains tax will add enticement and incentive to doing business in Oregon and support those that are already here contributing to our economy. It is important that capital gains treatment is simple, a simple rate reduction. Reinvestment may not work when one is retiring, and the optimum solution is not to reinvest. A simple capital gains reduced rate is the best legislative formula that we are advocating on behalf of our 7,000 Oregon members. Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, I also have some written testimony provided by the American Legislative Exchange Council, and has been provided to you in writing from Mr. Jonathan Williams, Tax and Fiscal Policy Task Force Director for the American Legislative American Exchange Council. And just to paraphrase quickly, ALEC is the nation's largest nonpartisan individual membership organization of state legislators. As task force director, Mr. Williams works with his members to develop policy to bring fundamental pro-growth and pro-taxpayer reforms to state tax systems. He's also co-author of Rich States, Poor States. Last year was their third annual publication, which compares all 50 states and their economic factors, 15 of them, that are influenced by legislative action. And in their studies and research, they placed Oregon at a disappointing 41st. and I encourage you to read his testimony and to refer to rich states, poor states, and their belief that capital gains is tax is very punitive to Oregon's economy. Thank you.
Thank you. Roger.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. Oregon Small Woodlands Association, OSWA, has about 1,500 members of forest land between 1 and 5,000 acres, and they have trees growing on their property. OSWA does a lot of things besides lobby. I won't go into those. I'd like to point out first and foremost that OSWA is in support of reducing or eliminating all capital gains taxes. When our members, or anyone for that matter, cuts trees and receives income from cutting of trees, it's literally a lifetime of work. I mean, our members are truly, they're harvesting what their ancestors established and they're reforesting for their next generation. So, and unlike other types of businesses we've heard about today where the people can pick up and move their businesses out of state, it's very difficult to pick up a tree farm and move it out of state. We're kind of here for the long run. So, with that caveat, I'd just like to go briefly through the bills that are in front of you today and how they would affect us and our preference on them. Of the seven bills that are up, Senate Bill 715 would be the one we prefer over all the rest of the bills. It is the simplest, the most direct. It allows the taxpayer to deduct capital gains from the federal income tax. It's cheap. I'm sorry, Senator Telfer, but it doesn't require a lot of CPA work in order to calculate the tax. It's the one we like. It's the method we prefer. Next would be Senate Bill 714 or 883. I think those two bills are virtually identical or at least identical in the way that they get to the reduction in the tax by basically reducing the rate in half. That would be our next choice. Again, it's simple. We believe in no capital gains, at least on timber, but a reduction would be welcomed. The concept in Senate Bill 336 we like. If there's going to be a tax on capital gains, we don't believe that tax should be in the general fund. We like the idea of the tax going into a rainy day fund or some special fund. Capital gains taxes by nature are not ordinary. They're not reoccurring. They can't be counted on. That's very evident by the fact the fluctuation we see in our tax, the amount of tax collected in capital gains. So if there's going to be a tax on capital gains, we think it should go into a rainy day fund, and we like that concept. And I hope I've got the numbers right. You have seven of them up
yep,
there.
You're right on.
Lastly, Senate Bills 824 and Senate Bill 8 do not fit our principle of support. Deferring payment of capital gains for a time, but then requiring taxpayer to pay it later when they've already invested the money and likely won't have money to pay the tax, we don't believe that's good policy, and that can get taxpayers in a bind at a later date. We would ask that you not take action on those types of bills and just reduce the rate or eliminate the rate in the tax instead. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions of this panel. Thank you very much. Okay, Arthur Towers, Alana Guinea, and Lori Wimmer.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer representing the Oregon Education Association. You're about to get my written testimony. We are here on behalf of our 45,000 members in opposition to the capital gains tax cut proposals before you. I know you'll be surprised to hear that.
You did sign up correctly, and you get a prize for that.
Thank you. And my prize will be no passage of these bills, right?
I didn't say that.
On behalf of our members, we are strongly opposed to the idea of giving special tax treatment for the realization of capital gains in Oregon's tax law, because we feel that we could ill afford with the $3.5 billion revenue shortfall that you all and we all are facing and the grim future ahead in terms of cuts for education and other vital services that we know Oregonians care about. Most plans to reduce capital gains taxes are not guaranteed to provide economic stimulus, job creation or business development incentives. I gave you before in testimony on a different bill the example of a car wash with 10 workers, that if a person could use their windfall from a capital gains tax cut to mechanize that business, for example, such that only 3 workers were now needed. So in effect, that particular capital gains tax cut could drive down the number of jobs available if increased mechanization in that business meant that 7 jobs were eliminated. So unless you had sideboards that made it explicitly for investments that were shown to create jobs, you could not guarantee that that would be the end result of a capital gains tax cut. But if you do ultimately move forward with some sort of break, we ask you to do so carefully. We ask that you consider that any rate reduction or subtraction you consider have the following 7 features: a reporting, certification, tracking, and enforcement process so that there can be some accountability and transparency with respect to your intended use of those windfall dollars. Sanctions, including clawback provisions tied to the rate cut for failure to meet those provisions. Corporate disclosure, so that the public can know where their resources are being invested with respect to that goal of job creation. And if possible, incentives to target investment in areas of the state hit hardest by our economic decline. A taxpayer must demonstrate, we think, that the qualifying investments do create jobs at good jobs at family wages, and that the tax break be economically efficient on a cost per job basis to be defensible. We further believe that any rate reduction must be tied to the successful package of a kicker reform package at the ballot, and that the cut ought to reward investments made subsequent to the enactment. And this is very important to us, subsequent to the enactment and effective date of the tax cut legislation. We believe investments made prior to the rate reduction should not qualify because clearly no inducement for that investment was required. So awarding a cut to such an investment constitutes only a windfall tax liability avoidance, but wouldn't have any beneficial policy outcome with respect to creating jobs. So we would ask that you would make any capital gains tax cut based on prospective investment. With thousands of teachers and other education employees about to lose their jobs due to Oregon's revenue shortfall, it's difficult to even contemplate passing a tax break for affluent individuals and companies that do business in Oregon. We would prefer that you leave the capital gains rate at its current level, which will, by the way, automatically decrease in 2 years without your action on any such bill. Because so many Oregonians are still unemployed, and we know that it's this committee's hope to find a strategy to induce investment that creates jobs and puts more people back to work, we ask that you remember, as one wise person once said, hope is not a strategy. We need a proven job creation strategy in Oregon, not just wishful thinking. Thank you.
Thank you. Who wants to go next?
Thank you, Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Morris, members of the committee. My name is Ilana Guinea. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. And I'd like to start by saying we've heard about jobs and the possibility of creating jobs with this bill, and this is a jobs creation session for us. I think I've started almost every testimony I've had talking about the job creation benefits of bills I've testified in favor of. On behalf of our 225,000 members in Oregon, we know that we need more jobs in the state. However, this is not a jobs creation bill. It really is not. And I'd like to talk about that in 3 points. The first is that this measure pulls money away from our state. It pulls money away from education. It pulls money away from healthcare, and it will cause cuts in jobs in those areas right at a time when the services that are being demanded from those providers are at an all-time high, at a decade's high at least. We're struggling as a state to make ends meet. We're looking at cutting jobs across the state. We don't need to be pulling more money out of our budget. The second point is that we talk about capital gains as if it's something separate from income, but capital gains is a type of income. Any capital gains tax cut or rate cut would be rewarding people who have extra income to invest, extra money to invest. Meanwhile, punishing Oregonians who have to work for a living, who have to live paycheck to paycheck, who don't have extra. I don't think that at this point, when so many people are unemployed, when so many people are struggling, we need to be cutting our income tax rates on people who have extra money to invest and leaving them at their current rate for people who are struggling. The third point is that if we are going to look at cutting capital gains for reinvestment in Oregon businesses, which we would hope that we don't adopt any of these bills, but if we're looking at some sort of change like that, we want to make sure that that tax cut is held to the same standards that other tax credits and tax cuts are, or should be, that they're transparent, that it is accountable, that we have a reporting mechanism so we know how many jobs are created on the money reinvested in Oregon, that we have analysis on the revenue impact to know if we're getting our money's worth or if this really is just a windfall. Many of the same standards that Lori just went over, I don't need to repeat all of them. I'd like to close by saying that you heard earlier that Oregon has a lower than average per capita income. And I'd like to suggest that that has nothing to do with our tax rate and much more to do with our income base, with our manufacturing base, with our industrial base, with where our jobs are in this state. We have a growing service sector. We have a shrinking manufacturing base, and that has a lot more to do with our per capita income in the state. We should be working on ways to put people back to work and to raise that per capita income at the bottom and the middle levels, not unleashing our top earners at the detriment of our state budget. Thank you.
Arthur.
For the record, my name is Arthur Towers, Political Director for Service Employees Union Local 503. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. I really don't relish you your job of trying to create a tax structure that's going to generate jobs in our economy. 50 legislatures in 50 states are working on the same project, none of them with a tremendous amount of success. At this time of record corporate profits, the jobs that are being created are going overseas, and I'm very worried that 9% unemployment will be the new normal. In regards to the legislation before you today, we are very concerned with it and opposed to reduction in some of the capital gains tax rates. On the issue of using the investments to create jobs, I seem to be repetitive in my testimony that the standard that we're looking at is the standard of the Echo Northwest, the same group that was cited earlier on by proponents, talked about every $1 million of investment of general fund in long-term care in Oregon creates 55 jobs through the drawdown of federal matching funds. And so, again, as you give proposed changes in the tax code that reduce the capital gains taxes by millions, again, look at that standard as a job creation standard, if you will. Secondly, again, we just have a very straightforward crisis in services. In today's papers, the headline was 5 more schools closing the Salem-Kaiser School District alone. In my hometown, in your hometown, Senator, we're closing one of our high schools. I mean, the systematic disinvestment in the public sector is going to be a challenge for our economy and for middle-class Oregonians who rely on these services. As you are picking winners and losers with your tax policy, I would just like to build on Ms. Wimmer's seventh point, that that any proposed cut ought to reward investments made subsequent to the enactment and effective date of the tax cut legislation. The idea that if you have the conviction that this is the right direction to go to encourage investment, then encourage investment, future investment. Don't reward past decisions that were made under the current policies. And finally, as this conversation moves forward, we are looking forward to engaging the sort of conversation the Senator has raised about the how we're going to do this in such a way if capital gains, if you're convinced that capital gains tax rates are a real detriment to economic activity, how do we lower that while at the same time making it a little bit more revenue neutral, since, again, there's pretty much general agreement that we do have a pretty low business tax rate across the board, all taxes considered. So with that, I'll close, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Arthur, did you, or anybody, but starting with Arthur, did you have form any opinion on when Mr. Wiggins brought up the notion of maybe treating different types of capital gains differently, for example, long-held versus, you know, a shorter period of time, or Oregon-located business is different than stock, for example? Did you hear that, and did you form any opinion on that?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, the testimony was interesting. I don't think they formed an opinion on that, and I think that would be part of the broader conversation. I guess I'd add that, I'll stop right there.
Thank you. Anybody else want to comment on that?
Madam Chair and committee members, for your record, again, Lori Wimmer, we said in our written testimony, and I didn't say it aloud, that though we like the idea of incenting business investment in Oregon, we understand that, and I'm not a lawyer, but I understand from those who are, that there is a Commerce Clause concern around Oregon-only investment. But with respect to the long-held versus the short-term, I hadn't considered it before, but if that is the specific problem that is most urgently needed to be solved, that would be one form of compromise. But once again, I would still say that with the exception of that piece, prospective investment, if we're truly trying to incent investment, prospective cuts ought to be the ones we focus on.
Thank you. Thank you. Other questions for the panel? Thank you very much. Our last panel that we have signed up will be Jody Weiser and Steve Robinson. Welcome.
It's nice to be here again. Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. Senator Telfer, could I ask you a question to begin?
Certainly.
Isn't there a provision, 26 U.S.C. 1202, that is helpful with people who are investing in small businesses?
Could you give me a context?
Well, I don't know it myself. So well, it's a 60% exclusion for investing in small businesses. That's the title I have.
I'm not familiar enough with the code section.
Okay. I remember reading the evaluation of the last time we had a targeted capital gains.
Okay, wait. Let's not have let's hear your testimony.
All right. So I want to speak first to this, the comparison of Washington and Oregon, because we do...
Introduce yourself, Jody.
Okay. Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. We do sit next to a state with a remarkably different economic situation and tax situation than ours. Washington is far wealthier than Oregon. It has more large businesses. It has higher per capita income. It has more personal wealth. And some believe that these differences can be fixed by lowering our capital gains tax rate. So it's something that the legislature can actually do something about. We're not so sure that's going to work. The differences between the two states are largely happenstance, their history, and their outside legislative control. For instance, Bill Gates' garage and Bill Boeing's timber business were located in Washington State, while Phil Knight's garage and Gertenwald's hat business were located in Oregon. Those weren't legislated things. They were just happenstance. Likewise, no one lured to Oregon such business leaders as Mr. Wendt with Beltwin, Mr. DeBoer with Lithia Motors, the Schnitzers with the Schnitzer Seal, Vollum with Tektronix, Les Schwab, or the Austins who own ADEC. They were here. They started their businesses here. And that is largely what happens in the business environment. Where one calls home isn't really within the legislature's purview. Now, there's the other question of who comes to Oregon, who moves their businesses here. Well, cheap power and water are significant enticements that lured Intel, Genentech, SolarWorld, Google, and many other industries north to Oregon, where the tax system is not that different from where they came, from whence they came. An electric bill of $55 million at Intel in Oregon is way better than one at over $100 million in California. And that's the kind of thing that helps make those kinds of business decisions, not just what the personal income tax rate is going to be. But again, water that's not salty and it's ample and cheap power are gifts of nature, not legislatures. Washington State also gets far more federal dollars than we get. The new Boeing contracts will help Oregon, but they'll help Washington State far more. But those contracts were not something either state was really affecting. Further, we're far from the point in time when decisions were made about where to locate military bases. We're actually closing bases, not opening new ones, so we're not going to change that. And there are billions and billions of dollars invested annually in Hanford's cleanup. That's not some money very many Oregonians would wish for in our state. Washington does have three times more large public companies, with Costco, Microsoft, PassCar, Amazon, Nordstrom's, Safeco, Starbucks, all leading the list. But Oregon exceeds Washington 8-1 in large privately held companies. Again, legislatures didn't decide this. This is just what came to be in each state. If you look at company headquarter decisions, the fact that we have few is in part because of the success of some of our companies who were bought out and their headquarters removed. If Mentor Graphics gets new ownership and control and it leaves the state, it won't be because of something people in this room did. Further, one hears of many millionaires who are Microsoft millionaires in Washington State because Bill Gates broadly distributed stock when he started his business. Oregon's major business owners have not done that. One doesn't hear of a like number of Intel, Nike, InFocus, Rosebrook Forest, Schnitzer, Tektronik millionaires. This difference has had a deep influence on the number of wealthy individuals in each state. But generosity in stock distribution comes in a company's early business plan, not taxes or legislation. Likewise, for decades, the primary tax system in each state has been largely outside of legislative control. The legislature in Washington State would like to have some income tax, but the citizens say no. And here we would like to have some sales tax, but the citizens say no. This is an economic story that you're not really able to change in any quick period of time. Of course, the wealthiest in Washington pay 5% less than the wealthiest in Oregon, and the bottom 80% of Washingtonians pay more than the bottom 80% of Oregonians by about the same 5%. This is then part of the cost of living, and so part of the reason salaries have to be higher in Washington State is that taxes are higher in Washington State by 5%. So there's part of the difference in per capita income right there, where we have a fairer, flatter tax system than theirs, and it means that salaries do not need to be as high to provide the same living standard for people in either state. So most of the difference in the economic situation, the wealth of Washington and Oregon are based on happenstance, history, and factors outside the control of the legislature. It's not our capital gains tax rate.
So, Jody, can you wrap this up? Because sure. Part of the perils of being at the end are we run out of time.
Right. So, of course, people do move to Washington State. But today you've heard many people talk about our 11% rate. And in 9 months, our rate will be 9.9% in 9 months. That's an enormous change that will probably cost our general fund, about $250 million. So that is a change, not this biennium, but not this biennium or the next biennium, but the following one. It rolls up. We aren't going to be the state with the highest capital gains tax rate for long. We've got 9 months to go, and then it will change. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Robinson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Steve Robinson. I'm an individual member of the Human Services Coalition and a policy analyst. I'm here to echo the sentiment that it's the bad luck of Oregon to live next to the state that has the most regressive, wealth-friendly tax system in the country. It makes it hard to compete. The main message of my testimony today is that those who would like to see a reduction in Oregon's capital gains rates need to come to you with a proposal that raises an equivalent amount of money in some other fashion, echoing Senator Hass's observations earlier. There's no question that the people and businesses that pay the lion's share of capital gains taxes are already in a very favorable tax situation in Oregon. A few examples of this fact. According to the Business-Based Council on State Taxation, Oregon has the third best ratio of all states of business taxes to government expenditures that benefit business. And the Tax Foundation's 2011 survey found that Oregon's business tax climate is the 14th best in the nation. Oregon's corporate taxes are low compared to other states, and the benefits corporations receive from state services are a better value for the dollar than other states. This comes from business-oriented organizations, national organizations. Corporate taxes, most of which are paid by very large national companies, not local ones based in Oregon, make up an ever-shrinking share of total state revenues. Back 30 years ago, corporations paid nearly 20% of income taxes. That number is down under 5% today. It used to be 20%, now it's 5%. The net state and local taxes paid by the top 5% of income earners is about 7%, according to a recurring study by the Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy. The lowest income earners pay nearly 9%, measured the same way. So while our income tax by itself is somewhat progressive, the total tax system is still tilted in favor of higher earners. So both corporations and high-income earners are already getting a good tax deal in Oregon. Now we're thinking about giving even more tax breaks in the form of the various bills you have before you. Basic message is if you let these taxpayers off the hook, let them pay an even smaller share of the tax bill, they'll reinvest that money in Oregon and create jobs. But keep in mind that the bulk of capital gains income is garnered by these out-of-state corporations who will just use the extra money to pad their executive bonuses and dividends for their Wall Street investors, or by predominantly high-income individuals who are investing most of their money in the stock and bond market, or cashing in long-held investments to fund their retirements. For the majority of these taxpayers, any cut in capital gains taxes will just be a windfall. By that, I mean we'd be rewarding them for things they would do anyway. You're no doubt familiar with the argument that it's unfair to tax someone who actually has to work for a living more than someone who lives off investment earnings. That's a point you should consider very carefully. But there's one more important inequity that would arise from any cut in personal capital gains taxes. You might know about the so-called tax-sheltered retirement funds, IRAs, 401ks, etc., that you and I are counting on to provide income in our golden years. You understand that all the capital gains from these funds will be taxed at ordinary income rates when we cash them in at retirement. Now think about those folks who have enough income that they have maxed out their IRAs and 401ks and invest their extra money in taxable accounts. Think about what a capital gains cut would do for them. If you invest $10,000 in a mutual fund IRA and cash it out 10 years later with an average 6% rate of return, you'll have a capital gain of $8,000. Since you'll pay the ordinary income tax rate of 9% on this gain, your tax bill will be $720. Compare this result to a high-income earner who invests the same $10,000 in the same fund but in a taxable account. Cashing out after 10 years, if the capital gains rate is cut from 9% down to, say, 5%, this person will pay taxes of only $400 compared to your $720. Is there a compelling reason why the state should put a bigger bite on your retirement fund than on a higher income person making the same investment? So my bottom line is, if some group asks you to reduce their capital gains taxes, you need to ask them the obvious question. How do you propose to make up the difference in a way that's fair to other taxpayers?
Thank you very much. Questions from the panel? Okay, that does it for people signed up. Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to talk on this subject very quickly?
I have that message.
Like
Madam
2 minutes max.
Not even that.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Bill Olson. I'm the co-chair of the Human Services Coalition Tax and Revenue Committee, along with John Mullen, who is backing me up there in the back of the row. I just need to make the point. This weird attire that you see today is associated with an event that the Campaign for Oregon Seniors and People with Disabilities is hosting today, and we've made the rounds in the offices trying to alert the legislature to the very serious cuts that are threatening our long-term care system in Oregon. And you've heard us before, but we just have to put this in context. Everything that we do that would reduce the revenue base and therefore revenue that might enable us to retain some services is a serious concern to us in this context. And I just asked you to consider that, and I know you will, but let's take a real hard look, because we're talking about the depth of cuts proposed in the governor's balanced budget. It's estimated would result in the loss of about 8,800 jobs. Those numbers can be argued, of course, but those are real jobs that exist today. And we are talking here about, I think, jobs that may be speculative if we're talking about a capital gains cut to incent the creation of jobs. That concludes my testimony, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Anybody else who wants to talk on this? Okay, we will close the public hearing on all of these measures. And we're going to open a quick work session on Senate Bill 250 for the purpose of incorporating an amendment, and then we will put this bill over. So, Day.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, in the packet you will see dash A9. In the original Senate Bill 250A, you see elements of oversight and ensuring accountability. Now, dash A9 is designed to ensure robust oversight and accountability. And what it does is it establishes the Office of Regional Educational Services for the purposes of coordinating the efforts of and providing leadership for regional education service delivery system. And it identifies the fund to fund this Office of Regional Educational Services. And I guess the Legislative Council will work with Senator Morris on this amendment. So,
okay. Senator Morris, we have in front of us copies of the Dash A9 amendment that was distributed earlier. I think everybody's had a chance to take a look at those. I don't see anybody jumping out of their seats. So, Senator Morris, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 9 amendments to Senate Bill 250.
Senator Morris
dated,
has...
Okay. 316.11. No, 314.11. Excuse me.
Okay. Senator Morris has moved the Dash 9 amendments to Senate Bill 250. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. With that, we will roll this bill over to our Monday meeting, and we are adjourned. So your help. Your help.